Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to the Sunday Roast. Sunday the 14th of May, and what a week it's been, travelling to the US, long days and back to the grind. You over your jet lag yet, Kev?
I think just about. It wasn't just the jet lag, it was having to stay 10 hours in JFK was tormented, to say the least. So, yeah.
I had the same as well, but not quite as long. I mean, I was lucky in the premise that I got to the airport and that the security queue was literally right round the airport terminal. And that when we were at check-in, they were saying, you better go and join the queue now. And I literally was like 5 minutes getting to the airplane before it boarded. But I was having to ask people in the queue, say, with another couple saying, look, when's your flight? And they were like 9 o'clock. And I was like, well, mine's in like 20 minutes. Is there any chance that I could go ahead? It feel cheeky, but at the end of the day, they were fine with it. So you don't have to get. But yeah. And you got unlucky on there, because it looked like that everything had just shut down. Like things weren't working at the air. The infrastructure was broken, right?
Yeah. No, the computers were all down. So it was a bit of a nightmare, but... Alas, I think I watched a premiership match or two and then got back in the queue. And then, then everybody was fighting because they'd been waiting for so long that they were all up, all rather tetsy because they'd been standing there for 6 or 7 hours. So, yeah, it was all very entertaining. Then we had a woman shrieking her head off saying, this is the worst airport and the worst airline in the world.
Amazing how people's emotions get. Like, you're traveling. It's a first world problem at the end of the day. You're flying around the world.
Pure entertainment it was at the end. So got back here. I think I slept like 14 or 15 hours the first day. And then it was actually my birthday, went out for a meal that night, and just about back to normal now, I think.
Good. Well, congratulations. Happy belated birthday. And
big 55.
This was my retirement.
Wanted. Yeah, I could, but I'm not going to right now because the market's crap.
I think you're very wise to not do that. Talking of news, we've seen the Bank of England have obviously raised their interest rates for a 12th consecutive time as it tries to stop prices rising so quickly. The rate has gone up to 4.5% from 4.25% following the meeting of the Monetary Policy Committee. Change means further pain for some homeowners, but it could benefit savers, although they don't seem to be passing those benefits on quite yet, do they, these banks? So,
yeah, I was reading an article about this and they were talking about the mortgage side of things. And there is such a huge proportion of people who went to fixed rate mortgages when they could see the writing on the wall, I think a year to 2 years ago, that actually these uplifts are not having as dramatic effect on as many people as would normally happen, because they've said going forward, we're nowhere near the point where repossessions have started to increase at a higher rate as in other cycles.
Yeah.
So it might not. It might be a softer land than everybody thinks. And obviously they're saying there's not going to be a recession at all now, and actually there should be growth. So I think within the next 6 to 12 months, we're going to get some of those problems, repossessions and stuff like that. But I think it's going to be a lot less problematic than people had imagined.
But I've got the numbers. There's 1.4 million households or people on trackers and variable rate deals. Usually they will see an immediate increase. So it's 1.4 million who will see that. But there's an estimated 356,000 mortgage borrowers that are going to face difficulties with repayments by, they reckon, July of next year. And that's according to the City Watchdog Financial Conduct Authority. So, yeah, you're right. But I mean, what they've seen, an increase of around 417 more a month since December 2021. So they've had to find an extra £400 a month, roughly. And that could obviously, they reckon there's one or two more increases in there yet, quarter points, which will push us to 5%. And I can see a 5% because they don't seem to be able to get a handle on this, the inflation levels at which are hitting 10.1. Now, don't forget, the bank and the government wanted to get the levels down to 2%, and there's no signs at the moment that we're even going to see it drop to 5% in the short term.
Yeah, no, the same article was talking about that there is no possibility that we're going to hit this 2% within this parliament. which is to the end of 2024. So there's no possibility inflation is going to drop to that. The counter of that is in the US, inflation has been dropping like a stone because it's gone below 5% there for the first time in 2 years. So they've got a handle on it by being very aggressive, but at the same time, they've had major problems. And even being in the US, it's really is the haves and the have-nots, as we saw ourselves when we were in Philadelphia and New York. And, you know, even in West Virginia, you know, there's people sleeping on the streets all over the place. And
yeah,
it's shocking to see, really, to be honest, in these supposedly first world countries that have everything going for them, but people just can't afford to live in them if they fall on hard times. It's you miss a paycheck, you're up the left, basically.
You're 1 month away, aren't you, from being homeless in the US? That's what they say. And I think there is a lot of truth in that. The prohibitive costs of their healthcare system. I mean, some people we were talking to were paying thousands and thousands, you know, $3,000-$4,000 a month, or just for the private healthcare for the family. So this week, obviously, we saw while we were away and we watched a little bit of the coverage of the King's coronation, which was obviously lots of pomp and circumstance. And, you know, the Brits do it very well, don't they? I think that there's a lot of people around the world who were watching on. It was broadcasting over 115 countries. And I think a lot of people were saying, wow, the Brits certainly do it well, don't they?
Yeah. It's all amazing pageantry, isn't it? We were even in a British shop there where we're in Chelsea Village and in New York.
Tailors of Keswick or something like that.
Tailors of Keswick with Scottish people running it, right? You know, because Keswick, as we know, is in the Lake District.
First thing I asked was, you Keswick, have you got Kendall Mincake? And the woman was like, in Scottish, we have it at Christmas, you know. But she was actually interviewed by the Daily Mail. There was a journalist who pulled her up, wasn't he? He was like, what are you doing? And he was in the area for the coronation and just to see what the Americans made of it. But yeah, I think you got your salad cream, didn't you?
They were having celebrations outside. Yeah, I managed to buy the most expensive salad cream in my entire life, $8 for a bottle of salad cream. And what was it? It was like a pie shop and different other things. But
yeah.
But the reason why I was saying that was not because of the British shop necessarily. It was more they were celebrating the coronation. And a woman at the desk when I was paying for my stuff bought a coronation bone china mug for $60. And I was like, are you nuts? You know, and she said, oh, I'll be drinking out of that. But obviously maybe in Chelsea in New York, Chelsea Village in New York, $60 is neither here nor there, you know. So, but I was amazed. An American woman buying that coronation mug, so there you go.
Yeah, but it's, as you say, it's revered, isn't it, around the world. So what else? I mean, obviously we've seen the Eurovision. Obviously we don't know the winner yet because this is recorded ahead of the Saturday night. I'm going for Ukraine again. It's an obvious one based on the fact that they won it last year. Obviously they couldn't host it this year, so England, the runners-up, hosting it in the beautiful Liverpool. Liverpool's putting Liverpool, not that Liverpool ever needed to be put on the map, but certainly Liverpool is in the news. People, all the fans have been interviewed this morning. They're saying they love the city. How can you not? So, yeah, I think it's going to be great. And I think that they've got let's face it, Ukraine are going to get a lot of votes, aren't they, in the situation they're in. So they're talking about whether they should let Zelensky address the Eurovision. It's an interesting one, isn't it? Because the organisers don't want to allow it to be a political type statement, and they shouldn't do, because it's not real, even though it is, we know it's political, Kev. All the votes are not on the quality of the music. The votes on your palling up to your mate, aren't they? The neighbours, you know.
That's right. It was a miracle we came second last year. We've been dead last for about the last 10 years.
So what do you think about Zelensky? Do you think Sunak saying let Zelensky address Eurovision?
I personally think if Eurovision is not political, then it shouldn't be.
Yeah.
You know, no matter, you know, I know which side I support, and I would like him to speak, but actually it's politicising the Eurovision. Is it already politicised? Yes. Is it in Liverpool, which would be, you know, very politically motivated in terms of wanting to say stuff and do stuff? Yes. So, I mean, even you saw in the Liverpool match last week, which I wasn't very happy about, but they played the national anthem. Everybody booed, or not everybody. A small proportion of people made a big deal and booed. As a Liverpool fan, not very happy about that, but obviously there's a group of people in Liverpool who just don't agree with the monarchy and don't agree with they have a very Labour view. Yeah, so there you go. Politics-wise, it's probably going to happen, let's be honest.
Today we have a particularly flavourful episode for you. We're going to talk about a company that's digging deep into the African soil to unearth future-facing opportunities. I'm talking about Aterian, formerly known as East Inco Mining and Exploration PLC, a company that made the leap from the aqueous growth market to the main market of the London Stock Exchange last year. To help us get under the skin of this transition and what it means for the company, we're thrilled to have with us two key figures from Aterian. First up, we have Charles Bray, Executive Chairman of Aterian. Charles brings over 30 years of experience from the financial markets. He's a Yale economics graduate who started his career in exchange derivatives trading, moved on to manage the convertible finance group at Credit Suisse, and then founded Aston Capital Management, an alternative fund management and capital markets boutique. Since joining Aterian in 2019, Charles has led the company's strategic refocus and recapitalization, which included a pivotal move into Rwanda. And joining Charles, we have Simon Rollison, the managing director of Aterian. Simon brings with him years of experience in the mining industry and a deep understanding of the strategic metals market. Together, they're going to give us a lowdown on their ambitious plans, their move to the main market, and the incredible portfolio of critical and strategic metal assets that they're developing. So as you finish your coffee, or perhaps you're preparing your Sunday roast, sit back, relax, and get ready for a hearty helping of insight right here on the Sunday roast. How's that for an introduction, gents?
Sounds good.
Good. So for all
There's no way Charles has been in the business for 30 years. He's only about 35 years old. When he was five. He's either that or he's aged very well. What's the crack going on here, Charles?
It's a bit of both. It's a bit of both.
Did you have an easy paper round?
I did, from an early age.
Very good. So for our listeners, can you tell us the Aterian story, the transition from East Inco, and just what the future holds?
Yeah, I think it's one of the key parts to that story is the fact that Simon's on, so I'm very happy to be doing this with him. When I got involved initially, the company was what I describe as a little tired in the sense that it was focused on coal, which is not necessarily a bad asset, but I feel it's a little backward looking. And now we're focused on critical and strategic metals. We've been able to, as you mentioned, acquire some assets in Rwanda that are very interesting. Simon was able to join with us, and that, I think, totally changed our perspective with respect to the exploration assets. So I'll let him talk about that in a little bit. But what I gleaned from my experiences is that strategically, if you're in the right place and then you build the right team, that you can generate some value. And we feel very strongly that the energy transition combined with the supply chain issues that exist and that were brought into focus, and most definitely with what's happening in Ukraine and in China post-COVID, creating an opportunity for the company to focus on critical strategic metals and to extract value from that. And so we've been able to, with our shareholding base, secure a lot of great backing, more importantly, some patience, and are now, I think, very well positioned to start to create that value or demonstrate to the market the value that has been created. So that's our focus. That's kind of our vision and what we're trying to do.
So the company really split into, I'm looking at a triangle here, and we've got the scenario, which is the trading platform, which we're trying to create here, I think, mainly based in Rwanda. You've then got the assets, 15 different licenses in Morocco, and then we have various different licenses also in Rwanda. So let's deal with those ones separately, and we'll start off with the trading platform. Why did that come about? What is the purpose of the trading platform? How does it work? Is that Simon that would know more about this, or Charles?
I think I'll jump in on that. And I mentioned in our last discussion that my background originally was trading. And I was fortunate enough to work with a group called O'Connor & Associates, started UBS O'Connor, then Paribas and Credit Suisse. And from that, I got a good understanding of commodity markets and how to trade them. This is far farther up the food chain than I've ever been in the sense that we're dealing with the mining and then the trading of the concentrates and ores that come from that mining. The rationale is simple. As an exploration company, we really don't want to dilute our shareholders. We understand that at some point you have to, and at some other point it may be in the best interest if that equity capital is the cheapest capital out there. However, we generally are looking to create a revenue generating business that allows for us to take positive cash flows and dedicate that to the exploration efforts. The exploration efforts we look at, or projects, I should say, as multiple options where if you can keep these things alive, they can create tremendous amounts of value over time. So what we did was in Rwanda, we applied for a trading license, which we received after an arduous due diligence process. And that allows us to acquire critical and strategic metals out of Central and East Africa. In particular from DRC, from Burundi, from Uganda, and more importantly, from Rwandans and Rwanda itself. And the model is fairly simple. We look to buy and aggregate from small-scale producers. We can purchase that at a reduced price relative to international trading prices. And then we can upgrade the material. We can make sure it meets specifications, and then we can deliver it to off-takers. So we have been developing the trading business over the past several months, and we're basically there and now looking to engage with those off-takers and to start generating cash flows to support our exploration efforts.
If you look at that, you go back to Rwanda when you first went in there as a country, principally a artisanal small-scale mining sector with these international trading companies buying off the traders and then moving it on. So, you know, as a company, we kind of thought, well, here's an opportunity, because if we can put ourselves in the middle of that and sort of like place ourselves in a better strategic position, we can sort of have a successful business that generates the revenue that we can then use for the exploration. So by looking at the model that we're building, it's working with these small scale miners to improve their production, improve their recovery, that then we can filter into our trading business that we can sell on. So it's kind of a win-win. It helps the small scale mining sector. It obviously helps us as a trading company, which then filters into our exploration efforts.
Sounds good. So give us the day-to-day challenges involved in that business and how it's actually going to make you some money.
Well, I mean, the trading, we're still on the verge of getting it up and running. We expect that to be sort of towards the end of June. A long process leading into where we get to today is basically that we had to get the ITSCI membership. So that's the International Tin Supply Chain Initiative. And it's a bit like the Kimberley Certificate of Diamonds, but this is dealing with the conflict minerals out of Central Africa. And that took about a year to get that membership awarded to us. So we cleared that hurdle at the beginning of the year. And now we're just putting the infrastructure and the personnel into place on the ground. We've been out around Rwanda and we've looked about 25 to 30 small scale operations where we think that with a small bit of investment, we can improve their productivity. You know, maybe they produce, say, as an example, 1 ton of concentrate a month from their small operation. We believe that we can assist them to increase that production, maybe to 2-3 tons. But it's also on the back end where they do their processing, because it's very fundamental and more rudimental. It's sort of basically a concrete sluice on the ground, which they run the material over. So a lot of the metal concentrates lost. So we want to look to see how we can improve that so we can help them on the mining and also help them on the recovery. So they go from 1 ton up to, say, 3 tons of concentrate a month, which we can then trade through our entity.
Okay, so it really is nuts and bolts on the ground helping the miners to grade the product. And are you also, you have that ability to do that in Rwanda yourself as well? So in other words, take the raw stuff themselves and then upgrade it?
Yeah, absolutely. Because what we're in the process of finalizing now in the capital, Kigali, is our sort of trading depot, or comptoir as they call it there, where we'll be able to have small scale miners bring in material and then we can sort of clean it, wash it, upgrade it. Because if we're shipping out material, we don't want to be shipping a sort of 20% concentrate. We want to be shipping a 30% concentrate, obviously, for the sort of transportation cost reduction.
Okay, and then this 10% upgrade is where you make your margin and your profit?
It certainly helps, because then we're sort of shaving off the transportation cost element. But, you know, we're in the process at the moment of just finalizing, hopefully, a relationship with a refiner. So we'll be able to, like, send the material onto the refinery direct, and capture a bit more of that that value.
Okay, and then I take it because of that process, you're in a situation where if you're selling 1 ton as opposed to selling 10 or 20 tons to the refiner, you're going to get a better price for it because there's higher amounts. You know, there is economies of scale in this in terms of what you can generate back or not.
Well, as a startup, looking at the trading side of things, you know, we have to sort of weigh it up. Ideally, if you had 20 tons, you put that in a container and you ship it, but that could be a sort of 3 month turnaround time. So we're evaluating and costing out the exercise now, where maybe we just start with the air freight, 3 tons, 5 tons. We take a higher transportation cost, but we get the cash flow turning around quicker.
Okay. So obviously, if you're going to fly this stuff, then obviously it has to be of a high grade. Otherwise, transportation cost is going to eat up the
profit. But it is a very valuable commodity to begin with. You know, the tantalum, I think at the moment in Kigali, the prices are roughly around about $160 a kilogram. So, you know, a 1 ton barrel of this material could be sort of $60,000 in value.
Wow. So you could pack your suitcase and have $3,000 or $4,000 in your suitcase. Two or three extra luggage bags would be worth it. Okay, so the hope is, I mean, if I give you a crystal ball, Charles, a year's time, so you're hoping to start this by the end of June. You know, this is Africa, this is mining, so let's give you some leeway. By the end of the summer, this will all be happening. A year from then on, what's our hopes and dreams that Aterion are doing, producing, returning in cash flow to Aterion, the company?
Yeah, year on, we're hoping that we can generate enough revenue to cover all the exploration costs. We can talk about how that can change based on the different relationships we develop with exploration. But in and of itself, if we were completely independent, that it would cover all of the operating costs for the company and all of the exploration costs. So it's a significant amount, and approximately, let's say, call it 1 to 2 million pounds of net revenue.
Okay, so 1 to 2 million pounds of effectively EBITDA if you don't spend any of that money on exploration is what you're hoping to attain.
The lower end, if we don't spend it. So from 0 to 1 million pounds EBITDA, including the spend on exploration, is what Anga was trying to say. So I think we're saying the same thing.
Yeah. Okay.
Depending on our exploration budgets and cost and how quickly we want to expand on that. So the trading business at the end of 1 year, let's say we start, like you said, that at the end of the summer, we're at full capacity. The end of 1 year from there, we're expecting that there will be a net positive figure. So the positive EBITDA.
So a net positive of maybe £1 million or thereabouts, if all things were good.
Yes.
Well, what I'm really trying to do is trying to separate that business out and say, what is that business worth, regardless of any exploration costs or anything else that you may incur. So, I mean, if we have a £1 million EBITDA business in a year's time, then effectively that probably covers most of your market capitalization as we speak right now, without any upside in terms of
exploration. That's exactly right. With no value assigned to any of the exploration assets. And as you said, we have 3 exciting ones in Rwanda and 15 different projects.
Yeah. And that I think for the listeners, I want to make a point after I'd interviewed you, or we'd interviewed you the last time, Charles, was that this is the interesting part of Aterion that is not the same as other miners, okay, that are purely exploration miners, is that this company is going to try and look after the cash flow by trading for all of its other assets and upside of the exploration. Now, whether it fully achieves that 100% is anybody's guess. And probably me being not positive completely, I would expect you're still going to need to have more money depending on the size of the assets and the amount of exploration you do. But that aside, this is a different opportunity because of this trading angle. You know, we look at some of the biggest companies on the market, like Glencore is one great example. You know, they built their whole business around trading and make billions literally on the trading. Now, we're not saying that you're going to become Glencore, but ultimately, this is the philosophy of Ethereum. Is that fair to say?
That's absolutely fair to say. And it's in, like, as I mentioned a couple of times, it's my background. So this is what I was taught to do to support businesses like this, get the trading side sorted, and you can support all the other activities.
Okay, great. So that's the first of the three parts that we're going to be talking about. So, Simon, let's move on to the next part, which I think would be Morocco. Reading some of the RNSs, I presume you've been spending some time in Marrakesh as well, so you've been a lucky boy. And eating some of those sheep's heads, sheep head meat, and watching the smoke rise from the souk. So tell us a little bit about what's happening in Morocco, and what do you see or envisage happening over the next 6 to 12 months?
Well, it's an interesting one because, you know, the company started in Rwanda with these sort of small rare metal pegmatite types of currencies, which are very sort of niche commodities. And we realized that we needed to expand the sort of the commodity interest for investors to make it more of an attractive proposition for people. So we had the opportunity to acquire these assets in Morocco. And we did that end of last year, and we picked up 15 projects, which are primarily looking at copper in Morocco. And it's a super destination in terms of infrastructure, your sort of geological exposure, your services related to mining. It's all in place in country. But because we've got 15 projects, you know, what we're trying to do is focus on a couple of key projects. So we've got one called Agdez, we've got Tata, and we've got Azra. And they're the key projects that have had the most work done on them. And we're just trying to sort of focus on those and drive those through so we don't spread ourselves too thin. But we are sort of continuing to do a little bit of work in the background on the other projects to start to build up that sort of level of understanding of where we are with them.
So what sort of assets have we got then in Morocco? What are the three that you've identified then?
Well, I suppose the lead project at the moment is what we call Agdez, which is in the Anti-Atlas Mountains. It's a 36-odd square kilometer license that's had quite a bit of work done on it in the past. So it's had over 700 sort of surface samples, some geophysics, some trenching. Hasn't been drilled yet, and that's what we're going to be looking at shortly. It's best described, I suppose, as a sort of hydrothermal structurally controlled deposit where you have sort of strong copper values associated with quite high silver as well. You know, we've had up to sort of 450 grams per ton of silver. Some of the copper values are up to sort of 20% from these grab samples. And the work done so far has identified five different sort of prospects within the license. So we were out there in January, February time, just following up an old geophysical survey that we completed to identify what was causing some of these anomalies. And now it's a matter of just putting the data together and see if we can sort of build ourselves towards putting a scout drill program in place. So the drilling there would really be looking at sort of defining the geological model in addition to sort of seeking out some great opportunity. So it's coming together quite nicely.
So when you say it's being created through thermal, this is this was once on the seabed, was it? And ultimately, the volcanic action has then caused copper and silver to be drawn up?
Well, it's pretty old rock, so there's been a lot going on there. I mean, the main sort of background sort of lithologies that you've got there are sort of volcanic sedimentary rocks that have been sort of fractured through northeast fault zones and shear zones. And then through these shear zones, had later igneous dikes intruding along these, and these have sort of brought up the mineralized fluids and themselves are mineralized. So it's all part of the process at the moment that we're going through is to build that model so we can fully understand what we're doing. Because, you know, you have to have that level of knowledge before you can really advance the project with a proper drill program.
I saw that you had some results from, was it the Jebelet S project as well announced, where you did some outcrop sampling. How encouraged were you by what you saw there, gentlemen?
Oh, that was really good. By location, obviously the favorite project. It's only 30 kilometers outside of Marrakesh. But the one area that we identified the copper was
we're going to Marrakesh, Phil.
Well, you know, the one part of the project was really exciting because the preliminary work that we've done on the ground with the team in Morocco has identified quite a dense sort of vein system that's hosting this mineralization, and that's supported by some quite nice grades. So, you know, up to 4.5% copper on some of the sort of samples that were collected. And I think, you know, the density of the network of veins that we're seeing there, it's going to present it as a very attractive exploration play. So we need to get out there and just sort of follow up there and continue the work that's been done. You know, in terms of topography, it's pretty flat, so it's easy as well for working. So it's not really a problem at all. one of the questions people often ask about exploration in Morocco is, you know, are you up in the mountains? And fortunately, most of our projects are on really good areas where access is good and there's infrastructure nearby.
Good. So the third project in Morocco would be what then?
I would say that's the Tata project. And Tata's in the southern part of the Western Atlas. It's a 140-odd square kilometer project. It's a sedimentary-hosted target. And I think this is the one that's catching the people's eyes when we speak to them about the company and our projects over in Morocco. We have done some limited sampling along the sedimentary contacts, and we've identified copper over about 4 or 5 kilometers of strike length. We know it continues because there's some old geological data that indicates additional mineralization along the strike of this body. But within our project, we still have about 25 square kilometers of strike length still to explore. So, you know, we had one value, I think it was like just over 2% copper coming out of the sediments. So very, very, very positive. It's located about 50 kilometers away from a development project owned by Managem that should be going to production shortly. And that is the same type of geological style of mineralization, one of these sedimentary hosted type of occurrences. You know, if you look at the copper exploration sort of going on around Africa, and obviously Botswana and the copper belt down there is very sort of much in focus. And this at Tata is very similar indeed.
Okay, very good. So in size or magnitude, I should say, that last one is obviously much bigger than the other two. Is that fair to say?
No, you're absolutely right. You know, because of the strike length that we have, it's a very, very, very exciting target for us.
And the other two are more around massive sulfides that they're coming to the surface and then we're approaching those or not?
No, it's not massive sulfides on the other projects. Like Agdas is sort of disseminated sulfides that's associated with these intrusive bodies and quartz veins situated along various sort of structures, mainly disseminated and blebby. There's no like massive great big lenses that we've identified to date. And the same with the Tata project, the sedimentary one. It's just disseminated copper that just traces along the bedding of these old sediments. And just to the north of Tata, we've got another project called Azra. It's about 25 to 30 kilometers away. And again, that has sedimentary copper that we've identified, but also it's got some sort of structurally controlled zones of copper. So we've got one structure that we've partly traced out, followed that for about a kilometer and a half, a couple of grab samples out of that that return values up to 3.5% copper. So, you know, there's a lot to do on the ground and a lot to follow up on, but the early indications are really encouraging.
The Azra and Tata projects offer the potential for scale when you start talking about kilometers and kilometers of strike length with good width and the nature, the sedimentary copper nature, at least in my limited geology experience. What I can say is those are the ones that get the questions from the potential partners that we're always trying to work with.
I think, you know, when we first met you guys down in Cape Town, in Daba, that's when we sort of realized that the projects that we'd acquired, and also in Rwanda, were attracting a lot of attention. And I think, you know, with the push towards copper and exploration, it's a new jurisdiction for people because it's kind of been overlooked, Morocco. Everywhere in the past, they've always looked down in sort of Zambia or Botswana or South America. But, you know, some of these places now have a lot of their own sort of political issues. The future's a little bit uncertain, isn't it, really? So a new sort of copper province such as Morocco, I think, is quite attractive to people.
Very good. So should we move on to Rwanda? I mean, obviously, there was an announcement only a couple of weeks ago where you updated the market on the, was it the HCK1 initial sort of project highlights? And obviously, we know lithium is very current at the moment with obviously the drive for EV, etc. I was watching a video a couple of days ago, and it sort of just highlights how much is needed of lithium for the production of not only for EV, but obviously in, you know, technology and things like that. And it said that for every EV, your average EV, you would need the equivalent amount of lithium required for the vehicle was equivalent to 10,000 mobile phones or iPhones, etc. So it just shows you how much actually is needed to go into one EV. Do you want to just talk us through how excited and encouraged you were by the results from the HCK1 project?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, that was very, very positive, I think, for us in Rwanda. I mean, if you step back and you look at Rwanda, it's kind of a small country that's nestled between two very big sort of producers of various commodities, be it Tanzania or DRC. So it's always been kind of overlooked. But the small-scale miners and artisanal miners have been focused on the so-called pegmatites, rare metal pegmatites, for years. But they're only mining in the upper weathered zone. Because it's Central Africa, you have weathering down to sort of 40, 50 meters. And for them, it's easy digging. And they're pulling out all the tantalum and the niobium and the tin out of these weathered zones. Now, the nature of these bodies, they're pegmatites. So they're like, how would you describe them? Sheet-like bodies. Are characterized as what you'd call LLCT pegmatites. So it's lithium, cesium, and tantalum. Now, it's always been a case where, well, we have the tantalum and the cesium, but where's the lithium? And so the lithium probably has been leached out of these upper layers because it's quite a soluble metal, and we believe it's sort of residual down in the fresh weathered rock. So the sampling that we did recently, we had some analysis done on it, some clever geochemical work, and it sort of indicated that there was good sort of indications that in the bedrock we would start to encounter lithium. And in the last couple of years, I suppose the last year and a half, yeah, there's more reports in Rwanda about lithium being identified. And I think that's really because it's in the last 2-3 years that a couple of companies are starting to put some holes into the ground and actually sort of identifying what's in the bedrock. You know, as I said, you know, most of the mining done in the past was just the artisanals and the weathered material because it was soft and easy to mine. So, you know, the geophysics has helped to outline the opportunity that we have on the HCK project, and now it's just a matter of following up on these targets to investigate the bedrock. But yeah, I think it's could totally change Rwanda as a mineral destination.
Yeah, I mean, that's very interesting because obviously there must be something going through Congo and into Rwanda, and then subsequently, as you said, Tanzania. I mean, it's all the same continent at the end of the day. Yeah. You know, it's under the ground. Yeah. So yeah, it's interesting. So there are many companies in Rwanda, but there is a lot of artisanal mining in Rwanda. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's very fair to say.
Very fair.
There's maybe two or three private companies that are doing some sort of more modern style of mining, shall we say. They're using proper equipment, but for the most part, it's just small scale artisanal type of operations.
And since the sort of Rwandan atrocities that occurred, obviously, there's obviously a lot of men, women, and children were killed, but I presume more men than anybody else. What is the situation on the ground in Rwanda?
If you went there now, you probably wouldn't even understand that something like that had occurred in the fairly recent past. They are the most friendly and polite people to work with. It's a really good destination for us, and we're very glad to be there.
Yeah, I'd just repeat that those exact same sentiments. I think one of the legacy issues is that some of the mining knowledge was lost, but the government, in particular the RMB, is working actively to, let's say, reinstate that knowledge, have it brought into the younger generation. We're working with them to do that. One of the things Simon was a bit shy of mentioning is he's been very active in terms of getting some of the students at the local universities engaged in some of our exploration efforts. Our local geologists are both young Rwandans who are very excited at the prospect of getting this technical knowledge and helping their country. But it's a great place to work, and we're very much looking forward to expanding our exploration efforts there. One of the things I would just quickly mention is HCK1 is one of what we believe are approximately 22 plus pegmatite zones on the project. And then we have an adjacent project called Dynasty, which has its own set of pegmatites. So if HCK1 is in any way replicated across that portfolio of pegmatites, it's incredibly exciting.
Because it's a very interesting target, actually. You know, we've traced it out through pitting the HCK1 target for about 2-2.5 kilometers. And in places, it can be up to 100 meters wide. So it's very, very interesting. And, you know, if we do the drilling and we identify the lithium potential there, and you think along the timeline to the future, and you said, okay, well, this is potentially going to be a mine, you don't have to, like, mine through 40 meters of waste to get to the fresh rock lithium. You're mining through the weathered pegmatite, which contains all the tantalum. So, you know, you can be making some money on your way down to the lithium.
So you would process the tantalum anyway and then carry on down. And then in the non-weathered rock, you're getting lithium, but you're also getting tantalum. And what was the other one? Cesium?
Niobium. You get niobium as well. You've got the LCT, so that's the lithium, cesium, tantalum. But really, the economic minerals that we'd be looking at would be the lithium and the tantalum. And to recover the tantalum is very straightforward. It's sort of just gravity separation, wash plants. So it's kind of what attracted us in the first place, I think, to Rwanda, because it'd been always overlooked. You know, everyone was going to DRC and everyone was going to Tanzania, where you find these incredibly large deposits. You know, these pegmatites aren't huge. You know, if you've got like 20 million, 30 million tons, you're onto a good one. But it's pretty quick to evaluate, pretty straightforward. And the processing plant that you'd put into place, if you're looking at the tantalum opportunity, isn't expensive. You know, you compare it to a gold mine where you're sort of spending hundreds of millions of dollars. It's not like that at all. You know, you can get a wash plant in place for sort of under $1 million, depending on the size of it, of course, that you want to put into production.
Okay, very good. So what's going to happen then with all of these assets? We've got Morocco. And the interesting thing was, where did the Moroccan assets come from? Where did you purchase those assets from in the first place?
Those came from our transaction we completed with Elemental Altus, which was formerly known as Altus Strategy. That's a royalty company. And they were doing base metal exploration across Morocco, parts of Egypt, all over Africa. They made the determination, or at least as I understand it, they made the determination to exit the base metal portfolio and to focus on gold and silver. And so they have a portfolio of royalties that come primarily from there. But they also have, and we, in exchange for 25% of our equity share capital, we were able to acquire the Aterian assets in Morocco. As well, we provided Elemental Altus with a royalty over those projects. So that's where they came from. We're happy to have Elemental Altus as a shareholder and are continuing to work with them on expanding their royalty portfolio with us, but as well, hopefully acquiring new exploration assets potentially from them.
So they own 25% of Aterian now.
That's correct.
And what sort of royalty values will they get from the different project? Percentage of net royalty or percentage of net royalty, or what's the situation?
Yes. Simon, you want to?
Yeah, it's a net royalty. 2.5% on the Moroccan assets.
Okay. So 2.5% of net smelter?
Yes. In a sorry.
Yeah. Okay. So in other words, they 2.5% of gross revenues, isn't it?
Yeah.
In terms of that. Okay, good. So you have a key shareholder there, and are they likely to help you and support you to get them to the royalty stage?
Every indication from them has been most definitely. They have been very supportive, communicative, and as I said, we continue to talk to them about the potential opportunities. When they see something interesting, they contact us, and we do the same with them. And we're hopeful that over the course of time, even in some places where they don't necessarily have a focus, like Rwanda, we can generate enough interest for more exploration and development activities to potentially even sell royalties onto them. So that's the relationship there. Obviously, we have a fiduciary obligation to seek out the very best and optimal pricing. So we'll always be doing that in conjunction with talking to potential other royalty companies. It's just we obviously have a strong preference to work with the people who we know well and who we're working with well.
So this is the company. This is the three sides. How do you see the exploration side of things going? I mean, you've stated in RNSs that in Rwanda, you're looking for partners to move forward. So tell us a little bit about how you see that progressing throughout 2023.
Yeah, just I'd say we've stated publicly we're looking for partners across Africa. And the reason we stated that is we have a big portfolio of very exciting exploration assets. In Rwanda, in particular, as it's becoming more and more exciting, we'll be looking to try to find the right sort of joint venture partner to help us there. And what that means is that as opposed to us spending, let's say, $500,000 to $1 million in exploration expense, we can ideally have some sort of earn-in where we spend nothing, which dramatically improves our position looking forward, but as well, it engages the right sort of partner for us to participate, ideally, in a mine one day. Because we are very excited about these exploration assets, we think that's something that's very feasible, both in Rwanda and in Morocco. So it kind of turns our potential cash outlay or our projected cash outlays from some amount that's fairly significant to almost nothing. And with more, we can focus on smaller sorts of exploration assets or those earlier stage exploration assets. I think I got that right, Simon.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, yeah, the opportunity that if you had an earning partner and he took care of the exploration spend on some of your projects allows you to free up more time to dedicate towards project generation, bring in more assets, and just keep the whole process rolling.
Yep, find the asset, move it up the curve, and then get the joint venture in to sort out what needs to be sorted out, and move on to find the next one. And yes, then you have a great group of projects, and these can be financed by the trading. You know, because then you're not talking about millions and millions of dollars. You're talking about, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars at maximum to take a project from start to further up the curve where it's required. Then you have somebody to come in and joint venture with you. So yeah, all sounds very exciting. And from a current market capitalization, certainly if you get the trading right, I think you're looking at very good value. Some massive copper projects, silver as an add-on, I think they're in Morocco, and obviously you got the tantalum and the lithium in Rwanda. I think the lithium is going to be snapped up by somebody for sure, because it's really is the hot metal at this moment in time, because it's going to be so much in demand. And effectively, there is a gap, isn't there, for both copper and lithium, that over the next number of years, there ain't going to be enough of it. It's as simple as that.
That's right.
You know,
we just recently saw one of our competitors in Morocco had a single exploration asset that has not had, at least in my estimation, not a significant amount of work done on it. It's had some work, but that was valued at 4.4 million Canadian for that single project. So as you said, if we can get the trading operational and supporting these other assets, I mean, the trading in and of itself would justify our existing market cap. If we said 3 million pounds was a fair estimation on this one asset in Morocco for our competitor, then, you know, I don't know what you assigned to our assets there, but there's something. And
you do, but you're not going to say it, Charles, because that's not very sensible.
No, it's not. It's not at all. But you know what I'm saying.
But more than 3 million pounds is what you're saying.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying.
Okay, well, guys, it's been a pleasure speaking to you, and thank you. We look forward to meeting you in the bazaar in Marrakesh at some point in the not-too-distant future, and come and see the progression in Rwanda as well, these assets, because I think when people see these things for real on the ground, as we just come back from Ben's Creek there in America, it makes it real for people, and that's obviously a good thing.
So when you were on last time, Charles, we obviously, being the Sunday roast, we did allude and asked you to what was your, you know, your ultimate Sunday roast. And I think you said it was one of your favorite pubs down in, was it in Twickenham or somewhere like that, where you hang out?
The Thatch Cottage in Ascot.
In Ascot, that was it, Ascot. I'll plug it again. Good one. So Simon, we'll come to you, because you've not given us your ultimate Sunday roast. What is it?
Oh, it's going to have to be roast lamb with a bit of rosemary and all the trimmings, and a bottle of chunky red next to it.
Very good.
There we go.
Yeah, roast lamb and mince sauce. Can't beat it with a big stick.
Thanks very much again, gents. And it all sounds very exciting.
Yes, it is. Thank you very much.
So this is a pretty different resource sector play. So what are your thoughts, Phil?
Yeah, I like it. As you say, I think you likened it to a kind of a very, very, very small Glencore, didn't you, in terms of their model with the trading side of things. I think Charles's experience of running, as we alluded to, that the whole Credit Suisse, and he's had the history of doing that sort of trading, I think that can add a massive amount of value to it. And I think you mentioned that from the value that they could generate, or the EBITDA that they could generate from just that part of the triangle, would represent potentially the current market cap, which I think is circa 8 million. So, you know, that there's no value assigned to any of the assets in Morocco or Rwanda. So for me, it looks like a really good story.
Yeah, yeah. And I think Charles is a good point. You know, Charles, as it said in the financial sector or the financial statement that they put out, that Charles is willing to give a capital float or lend money to the company to keep it going, you know, if they need cash. So I think Charles is a linchpin in this, and, you know, he's going to want to make it work, I think. And I can see from our previous interview with him regarding the trading that, you know, I think he's going to make that work, and I think he's going to make money out of that. And I think it could be a snowball scenario, you know, where once it starts, it's just going to keep on rolling and rolling. And obviously Simon is Simon Rawlinson is more the expert in terms of the mining side of things, and bringing a huge amount of experience. So yeah, should do well, I think.
Very good. So let's have a look at some of the week's movers and shakers. Starting with the shaker this week, we've had Purple Bricks, you know, the kind of the ailing estate, online estate agent company, and they got a warning of low activity levels. We're going to hit revenues in the financial year for 2024. So the company is obviously very low on cash. I think they're down to the last £9 million. I don't know what the cash burn is, but that was the figures mentioned in the RNS. In addition, a formal sale process has been launched earlier in 2023. That's yet to find any suitable suitors or offers. The company's assessment of discussions with the potential offerers concludes that any offer would be considerably less than the share price at the time of release. Hence why, you know, it was like, this is the level, it could be anywhere else.
So it crashed.
It crashed, yeah. It was down 80% one day. I think it is around... The share price is 1.48. Don't forget, this stock is trading 90% under its maximum. You know, it's 90% down on the years.
They were based on the fact that they could scale this up and continue to make, you know, good profits. Yeah. But it seems that was flawed somehow. Otherwise, it wouldn't be worth what it is today. So it's not that we don't need an online seller of houses, but how does that online seller of houses make money?
Yes.
When they're charging a few hundred quid to sell a house. I mean, even all of this doesn't happen in the US or in other countries. It's 1%, it's 0.5%, it's 2% of the value of the house. Whereas they're selling a £500,000 house for £1,000 or something like that. I don't know how that works, you know, yeah, in terms of...
I'm not sure what the business plan is or how profitable they've been in the past. I can have a quick look through some of their turnover, 15, 3 million, 18, 46, and they went up to sort of 90 million. Post-tax profits of 3.9 million in 2021. So not massive. And I think then they were in losses of 42 million for the 2022. So whatever happened, presumably that was part of the COVID phase, you know, from the previous year's results, when literally nobody was moving houses because you couldn't buy or sell properties during that sort of probably a year period. But ultimately, that they've said that an equity raise was still an option, but obviously interest had been very weak at that point. The year high, just to correct myself, was 20 pence, yes, and they were trading on Friday at 1.4 pence. So they were up a little bit, but they were much lower than that. I think they went down to like 1.3. So massive drop by around 90%, as I mentioned.
Yeah, I mean, it's priced now to completely fail, isn't it? So,
what else has been on the radar? Obviously, Ben's Creek had a good announcement on Friday morning. What do you want to add anything on that?
Well, yeah, Ben's Creek now 29.9% owned by Avani, one of the India's biggest resource sector dealer, if you like,
commodity trader.
Commodity trader, deals with the coal, deals with other assets as well. Yeah, I mean, you got to read between the lines here. Why would a commodity trader buy 29.9% of a coal company in the US? You know, effectively what it means is, I think Ben's Creek is now in play. It's 20p. There is 140 million shares on the market. Everything else is held by Avani, MBU, and the Conservative Party, including Adam Wilson, the CEO. So you've got £28 million on the market, and someone who's probably going to want to buy the whole thing. So what do you think is going to happen?
I mean, as you say, it's the maximum they can take without moving in for a takeover bid, isn't it? They're under 30%. They're poised. And I think you summed it up before. And I think that you got to ask yourself, why would somebody take 29.9%, just under the magical figure, which would trigger some sort of, well, it would trigger a takeover bid for the company, wouldn't it? So they've positioned themselves. And I think you summed it up. They've seen the potential here, when we've seen it ourselves recently, just how far it's come. And these companies want to have a guaranteed supply chain of met coal for the future, don't they? You know, this is it's not an easy resource to find, is it? Especially in this current climate.
Yeah, and this is with all these assets, isn't it? And all these resources. You know, this is security of tenure. I mean, we talked about it with Ethereum, even in terms of the lithium and in terms of their copper gold or what was it, copper silver in Morocco. You know, the scenario is that all of these things are becoming precious metals, if you like. It's not just gold and silver. They're becoming precious, and the ability to control your input of these things is very, very, very important. You know, all these gigafactories going up, the steel that's required to produce, the steel manufacturers need the met coals to produce the steel, and obviously the iron ore. We're going to have interlinking of industry and the mining sector going forward, I think, over the next sort of, let's say, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years to protect the supply lines. And sure. I think this is just the beginning of it. And Avani have taken this position where they go another step forward. Who knows? But it's probably quite likely, really, especially Benz Creek's value ridiculously low at the minute. From MBU's point of view, MBU sold at 18p because they had a big holding, and they have many other sort of irons in the fire. They've got building projects and all sorts of things going on in London as well. That capital is going to be used for something else, obviously, for themselves. And they've still left themselves with 23% plus in the game for whatever happens going forward.
Yeah, there was one particular quote from Adam in the podcast we did, which was released on Friday, and he said, "It's not every day you see an AIM commodity company have a major commodity buyer coming in and becoming the largest shareholder. It really is relatively unusual. All shareholders should be very excited as to why they have decided to take the largest stake they are permitted to take." Sums it up, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Very adequate.
And I suppose as my last comment, do you reckon Adam's going to take a cut price share sale if it happens?
No, I can't see it.
Can't see it myself. You know, he's in heavily. He's put a lot of sweat, effort. He is a workaholic, as we know. And, you know, he's going to want to be royally rewarded just like the rest of us, I think. So, yeah, let's see what happens.
Good.
But
so what else have we got this week? I know we talked about a couple. There was Cellular Goods, CBX, who had an announcement earlier in the week, basically talking about their product launching on Sephora.co.uk, which is their company's Look Better skincare range, available for purchase via that website, which is a commerce website, and then from the second half of May. Shares are up about 112% on the week, so that was nice to see a bit of life breathe back into that space. Drawing a few parallels with another company there.
Yeah, I mean, I think from its low ebb, it sounds like a huge return, 112%, but it was pretty damn low. I think you're talking a market cap now of about 6 or 7 million after it rose. But yeah, I mean, it's still a company that's fixated on one sector. And I think we've realized now with other issues that have happened, things like Love Hemp, and there's a whole multitude of them in that area, that you've got to be more expansive than that.
Yeah.
And I think that's where Chill Brands and Chill.com is going to win. Effectively, they added another product this week. I think it was a mushroom something or other, doing something or other. Don't ask me what it is, but go and check it out on chill.com. And there's going to be a whole plethora of products coming on. You know, it was quoted that there'll be 25 by the end of June. I've had confirmation that that's pretty much still on track, and hopefully that's going to happen. And Callum was visiting the vape thing in the UK on Friday in Birmingham, again, to talk to people who were going to be distributing the vape. So yeah, that we should have a UK vape shortly. US vapes being issued. What did you think of the vapes then? We tried them when we were in New York.
Yeah, I thought they were very good.
I mean, I'm not a smoker, so I'm the wrong person to ask.
Well, it's funny because I've got a few with me here, and ultimately they'll be given away, as I mentioned. We'll run a competition to let the let some listeners obviously get the opportunity to try those. I got back, and one of my good mates, he does vape, and I gave him the opportunity to try. I think I gave him the grapefruit, passion fruit, and grapefruit one, which I actually quite like. And he's substituted it. He smokes a nicotine one, and he loves it, and he's not gone back to his nicotine, so it's made him potentially nicotine, which is awesome. He said it's not as strong as the one, the flavor, or the obviously the buzz, because you, I said, well, you're gonna, you're obviously you're getting nicotine from it, so you're getting the hit, and it's probably is that's what the strength is in itself. But he said, no, it's absolutely lovely. He's loving it.
Excellent. So, I mean, if it really does become a replacement for the nicotine ones and people are healthier because of this, that would be amazing. I mean, I tried it and I've never smoked or vaped or anything in my life, and it was an enjoyable experience, if you like. I mean, I tried the mint one and it was, you know, it was very minty and it was nice.
That like zinginess, that menthol, doesn't it, around the mouth?
Yeah. It sort of dries your mouth a bit, which I didn't like, but I suppose that's what you do when you smoke or you vape, you, and then you're drinking while you're doing it, so, you know, your mouth isn't so dry. But yeah, I thought it was very good indeed. So yeah, I think Chill Brand's going to have a very, very busy next sort of 6 weeks of news and information that's going to be coming out, and, you know, fully expecting lots and lots of different agreements and lots of supply and distribution agreements that are going to be happening.
The other one that was interesting this week was Capital Metals, CMET. We've obviously had this CEO on in the past. Mineral Sands Company, they announced an offtake MOU signed with a company called LB Group, who have a market cap of $5.9 billion. And they're the world's leading manufacturer of high-performance titanium dioxide pigments and sponge to fund the project into production. So, wow, what a turnaround.
What a turnaround. This was a disaster in the making, wasn't it, in Sri Lanka? And I remember Michael Frayn and him catching his big lobster over Christmas, I think it was, or holidays when we were talking about it, because he was down in Australia. So, yeah, it's an absolute game changer. I mean, they're basically going to pay for everything to take them into production. So, by the looks of the agreement. So, yeah, I'm surprised they only went up as much as it did, because it really has changed the game completely. Obviously, you've still got the risk of Sri Lanka and what might be happening or not happening, but I think all of that has been sorted out, or is in the process of being sorted out. And
yeah, I think that they're in the process of trying to get the temporary suspension lifted by the Geological Survey and Mines Bureau of the company's industrial mining licenses. So that's the next big catalyst, if that
happens. Yeah, maybe that's the thing that's holding it back until they actually get that sorted out. And then the other one from the dead is good old Syme, S-Y-M-E, who's still sort of in morgue territory. But actually, here we are, 2 years later, I think it is, we finally have a
first inventory monetization.
Yes. I mean, we used to be dreaming about these maybe a year and a half ago that it actually would happen. And I think I finally bailed at 0.4 or something like that it was, I think. And so here we are, great week, up a lot. And it's at 0.08, is it?
Yeah.
It finished.
So, like 5, yeah.
Maybe there's life in the old dog, yeah. If they've actually got something going and they're going to make money from this, then, you know, good luck with the 58 billion shares or however many there is an issue that you said there was. So, yeah, overall, but not a particularly exciting week overall, though, really. I don't think there wasn't a lot happening, was there?
No.
And I think there is quite a lot of companies there with expectation of stuff that's going to happen over the coming months, and I think that could be quite exciting. So let's see what happens. I mean, last week I chose the bargain of the week as Eastar Resources, so that's my record bucked now. It's basically didn't really do anything. I think I said it was at 2.7 or 2.75, I think, last week, and it finished at 2.6 or 2.7 this week, so didn't go up at all, so now I'm completely useless, 3-1. But my bargain of the week for next week, because we'll keep going, has got to be Benn's Creek. It is now, in my view, fundamentally undervalued. Everything is in place. You cannot look at it and say, £75 million company. The assets alone are worth £75 million. There's well in excess of 20/30 years of resource there to be mined. Everything's been done. All the benching's been done. Two high wall miners are there. We saw the videos on Friday afternoon of the second high wall miner pumping out the coal. So there you go. You've got a business finished now, and all it's got to do is basically mine and produce. And ultimately, there can be problems with that, but you would imagine minor problems going forward. So we're going to have a million ton production. You're going to have a margin on that million pound production. And you've got all the assets and everything placed to make that work. And now you've got a 29.9% massive, billion-pound company who is waiting in the wings to see what happens.
I agree on that one. It's all primed after being out there. It's pretty much ready to go, as you say. It's not complete, but Adam's done his job there, hasn't he? You know, he's delivered what he said he was going to do. All right, there has been some delays on the way, and he alluded to those in the last podcast, but they've got on. They've got the second highwall miner in place. It's now turned on. We saw those videos of it throwing the coal out there, which is brilliant to see. And if anyone wants to see those, they'll be posted on our Twitter feed over the weekend. So yeah, I think it's prime ready to go.
And to think, what, 12 weeks after the IPO in October of 2021, this was 20p. Nothing was in place. Nothing. And now was in place. Its own fleet. The wash plant's completely working and effective and has been
It's 108 before the train had actually left the station, from memory.
that should be a phrase. Hit 108 before the train left the station. And now the train is leaving the station with, you know, four minimum trains and actually coming up to 7 and 8 minimum trains throughout the summer, I think, because they're basically going to be filling the whole ship for Mittal. You know, there you go. I mean, what more do you want?
Good. All right. Well, anything else you want to discuss, or are we done?
No, just looks like the race for the Champions League spots hotted up, which 3-4 weeks ago I wouldn't have even dreamt would be possible.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know really much. City, they've got the second leg, haven't they?
Yeah, I'm talking about the Premier League, though, this year.
Oh, sorry, I thought you meant the Champions League.
No, I'm talking about Newcastle.
Well, yeah, I mean,
Liverpool, Brighton.
I think all the games that the people at the bottom you thought were going to go down have twisted. I mean, Everton got a lucky win in, didn't they, which helped them.
Everton won 5-1, didn't they?
Yeah. I mean, we lose to Brighton, the same team. You can't get your head around it.
Yeah, no. And Forest also did well, didn't they? They won, I think.
Yeah.
So basically, like, Sam Allardyce's job now has just got a lot harder for Leeds, I think. I think Southampton, forget it, they're gone. But yeah, let's see who goes. Liverpool playing Leicester. If they lose another game now, and I think Leeds are playing Manchester City, actually, maybe. So yeah, let's see what happens. It's gonna be very interesting. Some excitement, and even Arsenal are pulling the game out. So you never know. All the things are still
going to be an exciting end to the season, that's for sure, both at the top and at the bottom, I think.
Yeah, and it was great to see Manchester City go to Madrid and draw 1-1 as well. Great goal from De Bruyne. Yeah. And yeah, I hope they beat Madrid when they come back to City and get to the final. I'd like to see them win it as British representatives. So.
All right, on that note, have a great rest of the weekend and we'll catch up next week.
Yeah, lots of interviews coming, I think. There's quite a few lined up in the next couple of weeks, so I look forward to doing those, and hopefully you can all have a listen to what's happened.
Yeah, thanks for listening.
Yep, thank you.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of The Sunday Roast, please email admin@thesundayroast.net.